Osiris.
Hello and welcome to the live show, where we do live things, talk about live music, and celebrate the vibe of being alive with live music. Matt Dwyer, you are live, coming to us from a studio unknown, but you are still doing it live. How are you?
I am doing great. I'm still kind of like in the afterglow of the show we talked about yesterday. we've got another heater to talk about today, a different kind of heater, and it takes us into a different era. And so I'm stoked to move into modern day Bruce.
I am too. And yeah, we are talking. You can see it if you're watching us. If you're listening, we are talking 7/31/2012, Helsinki, Finland. To the time, the longest Bruce show in existence. Has he eclipsed this since this?
No. There was a show in Philadelphia in 2016 where he came within seconds of breaking this record. I think like this show is like 4 hours, 4 minutes and 17 seconds or something like that. And I think the other one was like 4 hours, 4 minutes and like 3 seconds or something like that. So essentially like, you know, and that is, you know, the longest played show in North America. But it's cool because while this show is kind of like the one that everybody talks about because it is the longest of all time, this summer was like, he just kept stretching it and going further and further and further. I know I saw two shows in September right following this run. And the first one that I saw in Philly didn't break the 4 hour mark, but it was like 3 hours and 55 minutes or something like that. I mean, just an insane night of music. So this is a really cool era to be talking about, I think.
It is, yeah. We've done four Bruce episodes thus far. We've hopped around from the mid-80s back to the mid-70s, back to the late-80s, back to the late-70s, and kind of touched upon that classic period that people think about, like casual fans when they come into Bruce Springsteen. They're going to approach stuff through usually like Born to Run, Born in the USA in the 80s, Darkness on the Edge of Town. But I think we also really enjoyed talking the Tunnel of Love era and kind of where the band was at that point. This brings us to like, and we'll talk about this as we get into it, but like this big orchestral sound to this band, this kind of like review show where we hear all the eras of Bruce kind of intermixed and interspersed together. It's really interesting because the first Bruce show I saw was in 1999, and that was the big reunion tour. You had a lot of callbacks. I think the band knew they had something, but you kind of got the sense of like, are we just doing this one time? Like, what's that? Like, where are we going with this? And it was kind of at an era where there were a lot of reunion shows starting for classic rock acts. Obviously, they released The Rising a couple of years later. I saw them again in 2003, and then I wouldn't see Bruce again until this tour, the Wrecking Ball tour in 2012. I saw them at Wrigley Field, and it was similar to what you were talking about. I kind of wondered throughout the show, like, when is this going to end? Like, he's 63 years old. How in the world is he still doing this? And by the end of the concert, I was kind of just standing there. I couldn't dance anymore. I couldn't even raise my arms anymore. I couldn't yell. I was just like, this is like just in awe of what was happening on stage. I'm really stoked to talk about this era.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. They did two nights in Philly on that tour. It was Labor Day weekend, and I went to the first show with like kind of like my whole family. It was amazing. We were like four rows from the stage on the field, like just incredible experience. Played for 3 hours and 55 minutes, as I mentioned, and then there was a show the next night, and I was planning on going back. I really wanted to go find a ticket and go to the next night, and I was so tired the next day that I couldn't do it. I couldn't get myself off the couch. And I do, you know, four night fish runs, you know, five nights of jam cruise or whatever. And this single show just spent me. And this guy who was, you know, in his early 60s at the time, went out and did it again the next night. And, you know, shame on me because that show opened up with Eddie Vedder coming out for a couple of songs. So I definitely paid for that one. But yeah, I mean, this is an important year for the E Street Band overall for a lot of reasons that we'll talk about. And I think almost in a sense, kind of like the creation of like a new era of Bruce and the E Street Band.
That's a really good point. And I kind of want to just hone in here really quickly because I'm actually looking at the Bruce Bass set list. You and I saw shows two shows apart. Since you skipped the 9-3 show, you saw 9-2 2012 at Citizens Bank Park. I saw 9-7 at Wrigley Field. Okay. So two things that are really interesting to me. One, when you were at 9-2 2012, Bruce, I was at Dick's Sporting Goods seeing the best weekend of Fish I've ever seen. And I have this very distinct memory of leaving Denver the next morning on 9-3 with my wife, and we were driving back towards the Midwest. We were driving back towards Chicago. At this point in our lives, we had sold everything that we owned. We were on the road. We had just gotten married a week earlier. We were on the road. We were going back east for another wedding, coming back out west to do some work at a friend's farm, and then we were going over to Korea to live for a year. And so we were in this like very blissed out period in life that I probably will never be able to recreate again until like retirement. But I remember like talking to my mom the morning of 9-3, and she was like, "We're going to see Bruce on Friday." And I was like, "I don't know if I can do it. Like, I just saw Three Nights of Fish. It was the best Fish ever. I don't even know if I can see a concert for months. It was that good." And I went home and I walk into the Springsteen show, and he comes out and plays "Prove It All Night," "My Love Will Not Let You Down," "Out in the Street," "Hungry Heart," "We Take Care of Our Own" to open the show. And then midway through, Eddie Vedder comes out for Atlantic City. And it was just, I don't want to compare two different bands, but it was like this experience. I was like, how two weekends in a row did I get two of the best concerts I'll ever see in my entire life? I just felt so lucky at that time.
Yeah, not to dwell on this too much, but I was supposed to be at those Fish shows. I was supposed to be in Denver that weekend, and long story, but I wound up not being able to go, and the consolation prize was like, well, I'm going to go see Bruce in Philly with my family. And you are correct that those Fish shows are absolutely epic, but I really have never had any regrets about doing this. Now, I did actually wind up in Colorado at Dick's in 2016 when Bruce played this show I mentioned a couple minutes ago, which is essentially one of the longest shows ever that a lot of my friends and family were at too. So I've done it both ways.
It's you make your sacrifices where you can, but like Bruce, it the one thing that you honed in on that I kind of want to just explore here for a second, like this represents kind of the opening of a new era for the band in a lot of cases. We'll talk about it as we get into this show, but Clarence Clemons passed away about a year prior to this show in 2011. The band releases Wrecking Ball, which includes songs that the band had written, Bruce had written over the last few years, but also kind of in the immediate aftermath of Clemons passing away. And they go out on this world tour. We are talking about the final night in Europe on July 31st, 2012. The tour opened 2.5 months earlier in Seville on May 13th. But tell me, from your perspective, the band at this point has been back together for 13 years. Bruce has made a solo record. He has he's made, you know, a folk record based off of Pete Seeger songs. They've made a few records together. Magic obviously comes out in 2007. At this point, like the perception is kind of like, what is Bruce has nothing left to prove. Like, why are you doing massive world tours? Why are you still writing music when you could just go out and play like Born to Run and everybody would be happy? From your mind, what fascinates me is how he's still pushing ahead. But from your mind, like what represents a new era at this point in time?
Well, there's two aspects to it. One is the obvious, which is, you know, now you no longer have Danny and you no longer have Clarence, and the lineup is going to change. I'm going to put a pin in that for just a second, because the flip side and kind of what you were talking about is he had kind of been doing the type of show you were describing in the years when Danny and Clarence were both kind of towards the end of their lives. he was pushing new music, Magic, and you know, some of the other albums that came out. Exactly, yeah. Working on a Dream. But they would also do these shows where they would sometimes announce in advance, sometimes not, like, okay, on this night we're going to do Born to Run, you know, from start to finish, or we're going to do The Wild, The Innocent, The East Street Shuffle, with, you know, 2 hours of other material as well, but that's going to be kind of a focus of the show. So it's easy at that point to think that he's slipping into that kind of just like legacy act, review, whatever. And then this tour, there was a new album, very strong album. I mean, I love Wrecking Ball. A lot of really great material, but it kind of shifted him into this mode of like looking back a lot. And there's memories of Danny and there's memories of Clarence in these shows, which are very, very powerful. I think he was at a very introspective point in his life and he just sort of was trying to bring that, to the people. As far as the band, well, let's talk about the band later. Let's get into some of the general topics as well, and then we can explore what the lineup actually looked like and what the impact of that was on these shows.
Absolutely. So just to give some background in terms of where we're at, we are in Helsinki, Finland at this point in time. We are at their... What is considered, what would be, were they to have had the Olympics, we are at the Olympia Stadion, which is a venue that opened in 1898. It has absolutely no connection to the Olympics, despite the name, but there is a rumor that it was named this way just 2 years after the debut of the modern Olympics as a way to attract future bids. It hosted World Cup matches in 1958, as well as Women's World Cup matches in 1995. It's this beautiful stadium in just outside of Finland. In terms of where we're at, July 31st, 2012, we are actually in the middle of the London Olympics, and we're in the middle of the athletic dominance of Michael Phelps at this point in time. We are also, have to note, we are seeing the passing of one of the greatest 20th century historical fiction writers, Gore Vidal. So that is, death is in the air at these shows. Also have to note from a pop cultural standpoint, I got to ask you your opinion on this song. The number one song in America on July 31st, 2012 is Carly Rae Jepsen's Call Me Maybe. You have the floor. What are your thoughts on this song? Because I have thoughts on this song.
I don't actually. I'm so disconnected. I've been so disconnected from like pop music of that ilk for so long that, you know, of course I've heard the song in passing over the years, and I'm not trying to sound snobby or anything, but it just, it never was on my radar as something that I should give any degree of energy to.
I'm giving you a listening project to listen to this song until it like deeply affects you. This is one of my favorite songs of all time. I went to a lot of weddings in 2012, and like this was the song that if you wanted to see someone's aunt out on the dance floor just like going crazy, this was the song for it. And I just have like ridiculous memories of like late nights with a lot of friends listening to this song. This was also just, I'm wearing a Cubs hat. I saw Bruce at Wrigley Field. On this date, we traded for Kyle Hendricks, who was our starting pitcher the day that we won the World Series, Game 7, 2016. So very, very important date for me. Turning back to Bruce. So this is the final night of the European run that's been going on for 2.5 months at this point in time. The tour at large launches in the Wrecking Ball tour launches in March of 2012, mid-March, shortly after the album comes out. Where, and we talked a little bit about this, but like where do we see the band at this point halfway through this tour that's going to stretch on for another year and change?
Well, I think the biggest thing coming into this entire tour was the question of what was he going to do about the lineup, because now he doesn't have Danny, and more importantly, not to kind of, you know, diminish Danny's contributions to the band, but at this point, Charlie Giordano was integrated into the band. It was all working, but the big man has passed away. And I think it was somewhat unexpected. He had been in poor health for a while, but he did pass away relatively suddenly after he had, I believe, a stroke. And so it was that question of like, could the E Street Band even exist anymore? Because at the core of that, as important as all of those members of the band are, even including Miami Steve, it's always come down to Bruce and the big man, you know? And There was a lot of like, you know, oh, is he just going to pull in some like hot shot, you know, famous saxophone player, yeah, or is he going to take this opportunity to just disband the E Street Band and make it him and a bunch of ringers, and he can make all the money and it's, you know, whatever. And he did a very wise thing. Was he said, you can't replace the big man with one other person. So he hired an entire horn section, and including Clarence's nephew Jake, who's now a member of the band and plays those iconic solos. I believe he actually plays Clarence's saxophone on stage. Wow. And you had this creation of what I like to call the E Street Orchestra. So now there's like four horns plus Jake. There's three background singers. There's a percussionist, in addition to the full lineup of, you know, the E Street Band. You know, Susie Tyrell starts playing violin on this tour. I think she'd been maybe touring a little bit with them the years before that, which is harkens back to super, super early Bruce, because there was Suki Lav was in the band in like 73, 74. That's how you have like that gorgeous violin part at the beginning of Jungle Land. Yeah. So he basically like went all out and said like, all right, to let's go for the Phil Spector approach. Let's have this big, big, big band that can not only cover all of the parts, but just add to the whole experience. Because, you know, with these people that we've lost, we really need to stack the deck in order to bring the energy and the level of talent that they brought to the band. And, you know, there was a lot of concern in the fan community. And the first night of the tour at the Apollo Theater, I mean, they just blew everybody away, and it was like, okay, this is modern Bruce now. It's got the old sound, but it's enhanced. It's got the new sound. And you know, also, as I mentioned, the Wrecking Ball album was pretty successful. I think people liked a lot of that. And there was a whole component of those songs being injected into the show that really built this kind of new emotional narrative. That was a focus of this tour. So, coming out of tension and making this, you know, one of the all-time great Bruce tours, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like just from a larger pop cultural standpoint, this was on the radar in the same way that his reunion tour was in a lot of cases, because of that, the kind of unknown, you know, even for people who were following it from afar, going to your first show, knowing that Clarence wasn't going to be on stage with him, but it was an E Street show. I think, you know, there was a lot of unknowns, and then they came out, and this sound is just, it's wild to hear this show in conjunction with the show that we heard yesterday, 9/20/78, where there's like half the amount of people on stage, if not less. They are playing, they're like straining to just like be as big and in your face as possible. And here, this has the approach to me sonically of taking an incredibly well-crafted studio album and placing it on a live stage and combining that energy where like there's nothing missed. There's no moments where sound is missed, eclipsing from the speakers. It is just like bowling you over, but it also is incredibly tight. It's incredibly refined. And, you know, in some cases, it sounds like a natural evolutionary point for this band as they're aging, as they're continuing on with their career. But it also just like shocks you in the same way that the 78 show does. So let's dive into this show and into the larger themes of this overall concert. We touched a little bit on, we've talked here about like the E Street Orchestra initially, but I'm curious if like there's songs for you that stand out within this overall volume where you're like, when I hear that, I hear the band in like a bigger, kind of bolder standpoint than I have in other eras.
Yeah, I think that where it works the best is in kind of the material from this century, you know, the rising and newer. When you have these big emotional songs like My City of Ruins or, you know, Lonesome Day, where Waiting on a Sunny Day, that are kind of like these very kind of uplifting emotional moments. You know, we were talking a little bit yesterday about kind of the different segments of Bruce tours and how, like, as they got into the River tour and the Born in the USA tour and like things were stretching out, he'd have these kind of mini segments where it, maybe it's like a couple of acoustic songs, or maybe it's a couple of songs from one album. Maybe it's like a, you know, more of like a soulful area here. He's evolved from, you know, kind of like the gutter punk we talked about, through the, you know, the representing the working man, through the, you know, Bruce Sullen melancholy years in 88. Now it seems like he recognizes his power to uplift the audience and help everybody experience some joy that they may not be able to have experienced otherwise. I think he's very in tune to the times. This was smack dab in the middle of the Obama years, but that's not to say that everything was peachy keen at that point. Relatively speaking, it was then, but I think he recognized that, like, you know, his audience, a lot of them aging, like, have been through some shit, you know? And it's like, if you're here at this show, you know, let's talk about it. Let's do it together. And let me lift you up and help you feel better. A great example of that is My City of Ruins, which was kind of a centerpiece of this tour, where every night he would recognize Danny and he would recognize Clarence. But then he would also extend that feeling out to the audience and say, you know, who are you thinking about? And as long as we're thinking about them, they're here with us. They're all here with us. It was kind of a goosebumps moment in the middle of the show, where like people would be crying and raising their hands and getting very, very emotional. And that to me is kind of like what I think about in this show and a lot of shows from this tour, just that healing experience.
It's a really good point. And it kind of leads to something that I was thinking about with this idea of like the Bruce review, which I'll get into in a second, but like, that My City of Ruins, it's almost 20 minutes on this. It's 18 and a half minutes long. And, you know, there's this moment in it where you've been listening to Bruce long enough. Like, he talks about how when he was a kid, his mom used to take him to a graveyard on Friday night. And like, it sounds so Bruce-like. And then it's like, wait, you, like, as an 8-year-old, like, your mom was just taking to graveyards. And like, is this, where's the fact in the fiction? Where's the myth out of this? But like, you follow him because, you know, as he immediately, you know, he starts pushing towards like the people that he's lost and the band members he's lost, the friends, the family. And then the fact that he turns it on the audience, it kind of makes me think about this dichotomy we were talking about yesterday, where in the 70s, Bruce is chasing something and he feels it so deeply and he needs to get to this long-term goal of fully connecting with the audience, fully describing his own lived experience. And he does it so successfully that he becomes the biggest rock star on the planet for, you know, the first 5-6 years of the 80s and even into the Tunnel of Love era. But at that point, you start to see him wrestling with, what does that mean? And who am I actually? Am I actually projecting too much of myself? And am I actually like living life the way that I should live it? By this point in time, 25 years on from Tunnel of Love, he's now at a point where he's kind of come to terms with all those ups and downs, and he's seen life rebound in a way that I think was probably unexpected in the late 80s and early 1990s. But then aging comes in and you start to lose people close to you. Like, I remember, so every Springsteen show I've seen with my parents, and I've seen them over the course of 15, 20 years of seeing this guy go through challenges of losing siblings, losing good friends. And this show, I remember having just a really specific impact in that sort of manner. It's just wild to, you know, think of him going from this like very youthful yearning to this very, I don't want to say stereotypical, but everyone in like their late 30s, early 40s kind of goes through this slight crisis of, what am I actually doing? Like, am I actually like, I know that there's an end of the line here. Am I actually doing what I should be doing? To, he doesn't seem like he's entering his golden years now, but he like sounds as though he's recognizing all the lessons of the past, which it just kind of blows me away listening to this. But it also like, and My City of Ruins kind of starts this segment of this show. If you take it through Waiting on a Sunny Day, it's a 10 song segment here where he goes back to Asbury Park. He goes to Born in the USA. He goes to his Seeger sessions. He goes to the Rising. We hear kind of Bruce touching all these aspects of his larger career. Songs like Because the Night, which, you know, he writes, becomes a hit single outside of him, and, you know, showcases an alternate kind of timeline, an alternate avenue for Bruce throughout his career. We just hear in these segments like a 40-year career kind of condensed into 10 songs, which is something that he kind of did in the Born in the USA tours and in the Tunnel of Love eras, but now he has so much more perspective. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, he's got perspective. He also has the catalog that's deep enough where he can build out these little mini kind of sets and whatnot. And if he's going to be willing to play for close to 4 hours every night and stretch it further and further and further with every night on the tour, we should note without a set break either. I mean, these, the 1980, 81 shows where he was going for almost 4 hours had two sets in them and it was like 4 hours of music. This is, I mean, I looked at the the Bruce Bass log for this. It's like he came out at 7:53 and walked off stage at 11:59 at night. And the encore breaks, even for this tour, the shows that I saw, it would be like they really wouldn't even walk off the stage. Be like, okay, thank you, good night, and they'd start to walk away and be like, no, we're gonna keep playing more. So it was like a solid block of music, but with all of these different movements built into it, you know, different emotions, different aspects. I'll give you a great example. The show that I was talking about from Philly before, his theme when he came out was like this, it was Labor Day weekend. And he was like, we're going to make this a Labor Day, labor of love, and started out with like Summertime Blues and Sherry Darling. And like all these songs that referenced the beach and the summer and the heat and kept the lights on the whole time. And then all of a sudden it was like, boom, lights go down. All right, now we're going to get serious and we're going to play like Prove It All Night and stuff like that. So like he would do those types of things over the course of a 4 hour show that makes you feel like almost you're seeing like different acts at different points. But it's all tied together. And then of course leads into the ending where he, you know, it's the traditional East Street Band rave up bar band thing just in front of, you know, 50,000 people.
Yeah, it's the mini set aspect is really wild. The energy. I mean, I'm curious, this transition from a two set format to a single chunk of music over like 4.5, 5 hours. How in the hell is he doing this? Like, do you have any thoughts? Like how? Like, I mean, I've got to imagine there's a diet regimen, an exercise regimen that is like from outside of him. That's like, hey, if you're going to do this on stage, this is like actually what you're burning from a calorie standpoint. This is what you need from like a weight training standpoint. But like, you would imagine those 78 shows and 75 shows would be just based on the way that someone ages, like 6.5 hours with no break. But like the fact that he builds in a break to those shows and here he's just going all the way out. I just have no idea how he does it. It's insane.
My theory is that if you look carefully on stage, you know, in front of Max's drum riser, and apologize if there's some background noise, there's construction upstairs. there's this table and there's a whole bunch of cups on it and they all have this mysterious blue liquid in them. And it's easy to say that it's probably like Gatorade or something like that, but I think he's got something going on that he's not letting people know about, like some sort of like super cell and hydration regeneration thing that he's got going on all night. Either that or he's a superhero. I mean, those are like the two
options I can think of. I mean, it's all you can think of because like there's a joke in like NBA circles that when an aging player comes back for like age 34, 35 season and puts up career levels that they went to Germany and got like stem cell injections into their knee and are like suddenly stronger and, you know, able to perform like they were like 25 years old again. I mean, I've got to imagine. Well, and here's the thing that's like wild to me when I think about Bruce over the last now, we're almost 25 years since the 99 reunion. When they came back, he was he was turning 50 years old, I believe, that year. That in 1999 seemed like an aging super, like an aging musician. Like in 1999, that felt like you were kind of like starting to get over the hill and you were beyond your overall prime. Now, a 55-year-old or 50-year-old musician seems kind of like your middle of your career at this point in time. Like classic rock has been stretched so much because of these artists. There's a part of me that wonders if, like, when he came back then, he was just like, I don't know how much longer I have left, so I'm just going to give everything I have. And now we're almost 25 years into that phase of his career, and he still approaches every show that way. But I just, it's mind-blowing to me. I have no idea how he does it.
Yeah, and you know, you got to remember, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, he's somewhat early in the rock and roll era as well. I mean, if you consider that he basically started his career in like 1969, 1970 with, you know, writing songs and pulling the band together and everything like that. That's only like what, 6-7 years, maybe 10 behind like the Stones and the Beatles.
Totally.
And the story about, you know, McCartney and the Stones and everything is like, ah, can you believe they're still going off after all this time? Well, it's like, you were the first people to do it. So like, you're going to set the benchmark for like, how far can we actually do this? So what you're saying, I think is correct, because like, same thing. I remember seeing the Stones in 97. It was like, man, these guys are so old. This might be the last time. Never see them again. And here we are, you know, 25 years later, and they're still kicking. So that's kind of exciting. And I think Bruce has embraced that in a way that you described aptly, which is not just like, well, I want to keep doing this till I die, but like, I want to keep doing what I do as long as I possibly can. And I don't want to rest on my laurels. I want to make sure that just the way that I was in the 70s and 80s, I'm going out there and giving it every single ounce of my soul that I have every night. And that's even probably more of a tremendous feat than the physical one.
Yeah. Last thought that I have on this is, so I saw Dylan earlier this month, and he's 81 years old, and he somehow his voice has drastically improved over the last decade. I think he was taking a ton of vocal lessons as he was doing the Sinatra records, and it really showed itself on Rough and Rowdy Ways. And you hear it when you see him live. Like, he is hitting notes and hitting ranges that you never saw. Like, I didn't see when I was seeing him in the early 2000s. And when I was seeing him in the early 2000s, he was in his mid 60s. And I remember thinking distinctly after the last time I saw him, that's probably the last time I'll ever see him. I can't really imagine he continues touring at this level. That was 20 years ago. And when I walked out of the show, an 81-year-old Dylan, I was totally blown away. I thought, again, that is probably the last time that I'm going to see him. And I think I'm much more accurate on that. Maybe there's one more show that I've got that he's got in, like one more round in this, but I don't know how much longer we have left with him. Bruce is 72 right now, 72 or 73, I think 72. 10 years from now, he is going to be in his early 80s. I've seen videos, I've seen shows of Bruce over the last decade. Like, he's still running around. He's still giving energy, whereas like, no shot at Dylan, but like, Dylan's behind a piano standing there singing out at you. I guess I'm just, I can't imagine, but until he proves us wrong, that like 85-year-old Bruce is going to be running around on stage drinking blue liquid and yelling at us like from the top of his lungs for 4.5 hours. But like, can you really question that he's not going to?
No, I mean, you know, Mick Jagger's 79 and he still runs around on the stage like he did 20 years ago. So these guys are, you know, they're super wealthy. If they stay on top of their health and they're motivated, they take care of their voices, they take care of their bodies, you know, sky's the limit, hopefully. And I think, you know, ideally we'll be seeing a lot of Bruce in the 80s, and maybe he'll have to make some adjustments to the way he performs, but I can't see him slowing down at all. I mean, really, I mean, especially based on recent activity and, you know, output that he's had, he really does not seem to be slowing down at all.
Well, and all of this kind of leads to a discussion point that you and I circled around, which is, for me, it was this idea of endless energy. For you, it was, you know, as we noted factually, this is the longest E Street Band ever when it was played. One moment in particular really struck me, which was Badlands and the Land of Hope, or Land of Hope and Dreams, which is about a 14 and a half minute long track. The whole segment there of Badlands and Land of Hope and Dreams is about 20 minutes. And you just get this like you really know that Bruce is feeling it live when you hear him count off going into a song in just like this yelling fashion. And then the band comes in with this orchestral sound. It's just so wild to me to listen to this show. And there we are, 24 tracks into the concert, and the crowd is giving him everything. He's giving the crowd everything. And it's just this endless train of energy that happens. What are your thoughts on like that? And like the fact that he's stretching these shows out so long.
Oh, that's the magic trick, as he describes it. I mean, it's unbelievable to see, especially talking about some of the shows in the '80s and stuff like that. He would have these segments where he'd like bring it down for a while and like maybe play acoustic or play a handful of slower songs. It seems like in this show, you really never get more than like one song in a row that's cooling it off. You know, not to keep coming back to it, but the show I saw, you know, a month later, I was having an incredibly tough time finding some time to go to the bathroom.
Like, yeah.
Cause you just can't like, what are you going to miss? Like, you know, I mean, you're like, all right, cool. He's got to cool it down here. And then he plays Badlands or he plays Land of Hope and Dreams. And, that I think is like really what, when you describe going to the show versus listening to it on a recording, you can sit on your couch, drive your car and listen to a recording and you can get real amped up, but like on your feet for 4 hours straight, you know, giving him back everything that you've got because he's given you everything that he's got, that is exhausting. And, but it's like working out, right? Like you go for a run and your body's hurting and you're trying to push. And then you hit that runner's high and you're just kind of like in the flow state and you're going. And then when you stop at the end, the endorphin release is just like magical. You know what I mean? You feel exhausted, yeah, but you feel accomplished. And that I think is that feeling that I chase going to see this band is like, it's going to be fun. It's going to be intense. And at the end of it, my body is just going to be tingling because I've been through this experience. You know?
No, that's totally true. I have a memory of the show I saw where I finally found they do My City of Ruins, Spirit of the Night, Trapped, and then Jack of All Trades started. And I said, okay, I'm running to the bathroom. I'll be back here. That's it right there. And I come out and I hear this familiar chordal structure. And I'm like, what the hell is he playing right now? And I come up the steps and I'm like, oh my God, it's Atlantic City. I got to get back to my seat. And I come up the steps onto the walkway and I look at the screen and there's Eddie Vedder on the screen singing Atlantic City. And like, I come, like my wife has seen Eddie Vedder in person for the first time. And like, they're playing one of our favorite songs. And like, I was like, I'm not going to the bathroom for the rest of the show. Like, that was it. I don't know what else is going to happen tonight, but like, I can't do this. So I suffered through.
I went during Jack of All Trades, and I said, mentioned before, we were on the field very, very close to the stage. And I ran to get to the bathroom so fast that on the way up, I ran right past Adam Brandichel and Kurt Vile sitting next to each other at the show. And I was in the bathroom and I was like, I can't stop. I gotta just run right by them. So I think on the way back, I was like, I love you guys. And just like, going.
That's awesome, man. It's great because I'm just looking at your set list, Jack of All Trades, and then they do Human Touch, which what an Adam Grandishiel song. We'll be talking about that in the later episode. But you know, for me, I don't know, just this, those two songs, Badlands, Land of Hope and Dreams from this show. And then there's a moment late in the show where he gets word on stage that we've crossed 4 hours, and his acknowledgement of it as both an accomplishment, but also as kind of a challenge is just something that like, you hear it throughout this show. Like, he almost seems determined to like bring this stadium down, which you would hear months later when he came through America.
Yeah. One moment that I forgot about in the show as I was listening to it last night, I was remembered it. His level of understanding and self-awareness that this was going to be a big show. Like, I think he definitely planned to go past the 4 hour mark. He played right up until the curfew, I'm assuming, because he stopped at 11:59. But even like Loose Ends at the beginning of the show, before he plays it, he's like something like, it's been 10 years since we played this. We got to play it again. Like, of course we got to play it. Come on. Then can't play this song. Not play this song for 10 years. Let's go for it. And like, that level of like, you know, like nerdery. It'd be like if, you know, I mean, like Trey came on stage and was like, okay, guys, we're going to bust something out here. We're going to do something big. Like, instead of just leaving it to the nerds, he was like, no, this is what we're doing. We are bringing it to you.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. And like, you get it. This show has a number of debuts like throughout the overall tour, I believe. Rocking All Over the World, Loose Ends, Back in Your Arms are all being played for the first time on this European tour. So like, he's kind of showcasing this tour as a, or this stop as, all right, we've been over in Europe for 2 months, which like, just as a pause, like from a performing musician standpoint, to spend 2.5 months in Europe in the late spring and early summer sounds like the perfect way to just exist. And to end here, like still midsummer in Finland, where like the sun is out throughout the evening, it just sounds like a perfect spot. But to then like say, hey, I've been all over this continent and I'm going to throw a bunch of songs in here that I haven't played before for anyone who's traveling from outside of Finland, for everyone who's here in Finland. It's a real testament to, you know, his just appreciation for everybody at this point in the overall tour.
Yeah. One of those mystical things that I'm probably reading way too much into. I love the fact that they open the show with Rockin' All Over the World, of course, the Creedence song. And it was the first time they'd played it on this tour, and I think first time since like 2008 or something like that. Rockin' All Over the World is appropriate for a marathon show because Rockin' All Over the World was also the first song that was played at Live Aid. And open up that whole thing. So probably reading way too much into it, but that song to me now signifies like, all right, we're going for it. It's going to be a long one.
You wonder why Fish didn't open set two of Big Cypress with Rockin' All Over the World. You know, it's right there for you. As we kind of start to like wind down, one thought that I've mentioned this, but I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on it as well. Like, I talked about this at the top of the show. At this point in time, like, Bruce has absolutely nothing to prove. Like, he could have been releasing greatest hits and live archive releases throughout the 2000s, 2010s, into the 2020s of stuff that literally just stops in 1988 and be good. And like, you know, you're going to like, he'd be fine, but he's still writing songs. And to me, all of this sound of aging Bruce, who is still trying to prove something. And it's almost as though he's trying to prove something against time itself. All is wrapped up in the song The Rising, where that song harkens back to these moments that he really connected with audiences in the 70s and in the 80s, but also like puts you in a very firm time frame of when the song was written, not just from, you know, September 11th and where America was at that point in time and like what Bruce meant to the larger culture, but also like from a band reunion standpoint and from him like reviving this project that had gone dormant for so long. Hearing that song in this show, it comes right before Badlands. So we're 21 songs into the show. It just kind of signifies for me the overall sound of this band, the orchestral style, but also this just relentless energy. I'm curious if you agree with that, or if there's a different song that kind of represents them for you.
No, the Rising, I think it's hard to argue with the fact that that was a turning point in Bruce's songwriting and his career, and really became the impetus for like this entire last 20 years of the way that they've been playing. The 99 shows were great. They were fantastic. They were, you know, they were greatest hits shows. He did have a couple of new songs. I don't think that they were the strongest songs because, you know, at this point we've, you know, your famous rock star getting your famous band back together to make a whole lot of money on touring. Where's the motivation for like the true chip on your shoulder kind of writing that you need to be doing? And The Rising represents a moment when he was connected with his people, you know, the North Jersey, the New York people who have just been Americans, you know, everybody who had just been through this trauma. And in the way that he could, you know, earlier with a song like Factory or Darkness on the Edge of Town, connect with his people and represent them, I think there was a lot of self-awareness from him that he could not only identify with those people, but also lead people out of darkness with his power. I think he realized what he could do. He could have very easily written his post 9/11 album as a very, very dark, depressing kind of woe is us sort of album. And that's not what he did. You know, he writes this song, The Rising, about the firefighters climbing the towers and saving people. And I'm almost getting choked up thinking about it. Like, goes back to what I was saying earlier in the show. Like, I think he around that point recognized, like, I can help people. I can help people get through things. I can help my fans. I can, and I can process my own emotions, but in a way that's not self-loathing or, you know, oh, poor me, but is like, it's like church. It's like a preacher. It's like, you're going to come and you have a lot of stuff going on in your life, but I'm going to lift you up and you're going to leave this room feeling better than you did before. And that's, I think, the motif for a lot of these shows in the last 20 years. And it all goes back to The Rising, and not just the song, but all the material on that album.
It's a really good way to put it. And I mean, it's just like, it's really fascinating to me the way that he has managed these last 20 years, which when they came back was an unknown of how long is this going to exist for. And then The Rising comes out, and that's a huge record at the time. But since then, he's had this knack for experimenting while staying true to this idea that part of the experimentation is within connecting with audiences to bring them to a better place. And there have been moments where it hasn't worked as well. There have been moments where it's worked incredibly well. And I think that this show, the fact that it's 10 years ago, and we're still talking about current Bruce at this point in time, and we've still seen him come out with records over the last, you know, 10 years that have been really, really incredible moments. You know, it really showcases a guy who I think still understands the present and like the importance of being true to the moment and true to the present, but also celebrating these best moments of his past. And I think, like, it's wild to me to think about this album and 8 years later, Letter to You comes out, which is an incredible testament to where the guy was at that point in time as well. And all of this is kind of wrapped up in a dedication to how do I help you, the listener, but also how do I still stay true to me? I'm curious, before we get to our final awards segment, do you have a favorite Bruce record since they came back in 99?
The Rising, I think is definitely it. If I picked one other, it would probably be Wrecking Ball. Like, the two of them have just sort of the emotional weight of recognition of, you know, loss, and but that there's hope and that we can stick together and that we can help each other out. And I think that's a really good message and what I hope to take from his material in the modern era.
I always go with Magic. That strikes me as, like, if you took 70s era Bruce and put it in the mid 2000s, just got like such an energy to it that I love. But I think the important thing is, like, you The Rising, and Wrecking Ball are, like, they're right there with it in terms of, like, their overall strength in my mind. And Letter to You was one of my favorites of 2020, but he just keeps making incredible music. And it's a huge testament to his creativity and his drive, as we show here. What was, for you in this show, what was your most Bruce moment?
You know, I might break the rules here a little bit, because I'm going to talk about something that's not on the recording, but is a part of the show, which I've never heard. I don't know if there's really any recording of it, but to top off the fact that they played for over 4 hours in front of this huge stadium crowd, what you may not know is that Bruce actually played another acoustic set before this. So they I guess in Europe, like, they let the people in for the pit for the early entry, like, very, very early, like hours early. And these people, a lot of them had been kind of like on Bruce tour in Europe, seeing different shows, and they're sitting out in the sun for, you know, hours and hours roasting and just like waiting for with bated breath. So for this, the final night of the tour, they got all of the people into the pit, which is, you know, I don't know, maybe like 1,000, 2,000 people or something like that. And then Bruce came out on stage with an acoustic guitar and played an acoustic mini set of rarities for these people. So like, as if playing the longest show ever is not enough, there was more music that he was just like, I have to treat my people. I have to recognize my people and what's going on. So that to me is just as Bruce as it gets. If I had to pick something from the show itself, I think I always go back to the last quarter, but you know, the playing stuff like Your Love Keeps Lifting Me Higher and Higher, like yeah. That always, I just love the bar band stuff when they do that. So yeah, that's what I'd go with.
I think that's such a great pick. And yeah, the last quarter bar band sort of stuff, it's wild. It's, I just remember when he ended with Twist and Shout at the show that I saw in Wrigley, and Eddie Vedder's just on stage dancing. He's not even playing a guitar. He's just dancing. And you can see kind of what we were just talking about. Eddie Vedder in 2012 is 20 years into his career. He's where Bruce Springsteen was when he wrote basically when he wrote Tunnel of Love, or when that tour ended and he's getting ready to do Human Touch and Lucky Town. And, you know, it's basically where Eddie is stepping into a classic rock period in his overall career. And him to look like a kid on stage dancing around to a bar band song with Bruce Springsteen. But for me, the biggest thing, and it blew me away listening to this. There's so much cursing in this show. And there's this great moment before he plays Does This Bus Stop at 82nd Street, where he goes, "Buses are great. We don't have any fucking those things in America." And like, the crowd just loses their mind. And it's like this moment of the American working man connecting with European audiences. It is something that puts it so firmly in the Obama years and ties Bruce to his larger political messaging. And also just like, It harkens back to him playing in a bar and him just being like, "You 20 people that are here giving it your all with me, like, this is all that matters right now."
When we talked about the Passaic show yesterday, one of the things I mentioned was like, he was playing a mixture of arenas and theaters, and how the connection to the audience in the Capitol Theater is so deep, and it seems like he's just having a conversation with people. I get a very, very similar vibe at points in this show where he's just like, not trying to play for 80,000 people or whatever it was. He's just like, going to talk to the people right in front of him. And that's really cool that he still has that kind of down to earth connection with the crowd.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any last thoughts about this show and about this era?
You know, I just to reiterate, I mean, 2012 is one of my favorite tours that they've ever done. I think that there was unfortunately, out of the, you know, shadow of the passing of several members of the band, he grabbed the bull by the horns and, you know, dictated his own future. You saw that a lot on the 2016 tour as well.
Yeah.
They had similarly amazing, epic shows. And I think that's what we're going to see next year in 2023, particularly when they make it to the stadium leg. I mean, I'm really hoping that this same kind of uplifting thing happens. You know, we haven't, not to get too heavy or anything, but like, the last time Bruce toured and we all saw shows was right before Trump got elected. And I think that there's going to be a lot of that healing that has to happen with people. And I'm hoping Bruce can help us out with that next year.
Get a little bit choked up just thinking about that aspect of it. But yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. And like, I remember in 2009 when Phish came back, there was a big article about their reunion at Hampton. And I remember Trey specifically being quoted saying, it's really hard out there and we feel like we're coming back for a service and to really give people something. And there's something to that, that Bruce has always been a part of. I mean, the majority of his career has been in, you know, New Jersey in the 70s as factory jobs are being lost and as inflation is high and as politics are in turmoil. The 1980s, you know, he very clearly comes out on one side of the political divide that's really not popular at that point in time, but is, you know, where he put his stake in. And in the last 30 years, as he's seen the political evolution in America and as he's seen economic ups and downs, he's really been there to showcase that, hey, these songs that I wrote in the 70s, they're actually really relevant here today. And also, like, I feel the pain that a lot of you all have out there. So I'm, right there with you. We will be back. We are not recording a 4-hour episode here today, though I feel like we could continue talking and celebrating and just jump into our shows that we saw in Philly and Chicago and how much they meant. I'm looking at the ticket right now above me. We will be back on Tuesday. We will be covering, we've talked about this a little bit in this episode, but we will be covering 10/23/1999, which I believe that this show is from Los Angeles. Is this correct? Is this the Staples Center show, Los Angeles, California, October 23rd, 1999. This is towards the end of that. This was about a month after we both saw Bruce for the first time. So I think that, again, we should have our own personal memories, but also really showcase where the band was at their peak at this point.
Yeah. And so that we're not all gushy, and I'll give you a little preview, maybe some like not completely positive comments about it as well. There's
yes,
both sides of the coin for this show. So it'll be interesting to dissect that.
I'm excited to dive into it. I think that, yeah, there's the idea of this classic rock revival show, I think, is going to be ever present here, but I'm really excited to dive into this, as well as not to give away what we're going to be talking about, but we have another huge, huge show that is coming up on Wednesday, and then a really just memorializing show that will happen on Thursday. So some really cool stuff coming up next week. Really excited to continue diving into the larger live archive catalog here of Bruce Springsteen. But thanks everyone for hanging with us, and thanks everyone for listening. This was a ton of fun to dive into 7/31/2012. Cyrus.